This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show for your Friday. Good to be with you today. Matt and Patrick here. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. We'll have later on Brett Johnson stopping on by. Ricardo Lopez joins him to talk about the Grotto, the new Senate Republican lobbyist party room. We'll talk to them about that. Patrick, I was looking forward to this Friday because this is our last Friday before Thanksgiving. We'll do two shows next week. We're going to take off. I think we're going to have a fill-in host on Wednesday and then best of shows on Thursday, Thanksgiving Day, and Friday. And so I wanted to kind of have a nice thing. I got coming up a little bit later on. Austin Dury is going to join us from the band Dury, and I don't know if you've caught them. Have you seen them yet?
I have not seen them yet.
They broke via primarily TikTok. I first saw their video for their first song, Who's Laughing Now, on Twitter. Instantly fell in love with these guys. These guys are great. And, I mean, to a point where there have been times I have looked at a band and I said, wow, you guys are going to be huge. I remember the first time I heard Dessa sing, I was like, yeah, you're going to be massive. And, you know, mission accomplished. She's huge. I remember the Churches, who just were in town here on Wednesday night over at the Armory. I remember the first time I heard the song Lies from them, which was probably, 2014, maybe 2013. And I said, okay, this is a kind of a techno dance band, but these guys are good and they're really good. And yeah, mission accomplished. Now they're doing worldwide tours. Dury, out of Burnsville, is going to be huge. I mean, I think these guys, I mean, if they stick with it, if they keep going, and that's up to them. I'll get into the story of them a little bit later on. I was all set to go Friday. I had a band interview, Ricardo Lopez. We can do kind of a little bit of the negative stuff with the coronavirus update this hour, and then maybe some lighter stories go into the weekend. Nice. But no, nope, not going to the world, the karma of the world's not going to play nice. And I can tell you, this is the feelings I have now remind me so much of early summer last year, of just this feeling of we're in this coronavirus pandemic. We've got all these, you know, there's plenty of bad news there going around. I'll get to all that here in a little bit. But then on top of it, a story which has a tendency to override a lot of other things. A verdict that, frankly, if you were paying attention to this trial, is not a surprise. My God, that judge was atrocious. Judge Schroeder, you are an absolute jackass, sir. And I'm sorry. You went into that trial determined to give Kyle Rittenhouse a cuddle and a snuggle as you send him back down to Illinois. And I'll get back to that in a second. The story as it's broken, the jury found Kyle Rittenhouse not guilty Friday on all charges stemming from the 2020 shootings that killed two people and severely injured another during a chaotic protest against racial injustice in Kenosha, Wisconsin. The jury delivered its verdict Friday afternoon after 3.5 days of deliberation, followed by a high-profile 3-week murder trial. As the verdict was read aloud, Rittenhouse reacted by falling to the ground briefly before crying and hugging his defense attorney. When the minute the judge said you can't look at the people that he shot and call them victims, but then allowed the defense to call them rioters and looters and arsonists, even though there was no evidence any of the people that he shot did any of that stuff. That was when you saw what the reality of what was going on. This was a fixed trial. And we talked with Jack Rice about a few days ago, and said even the prosecutor seems to have been set up here. Like they went and found the worst freaking prosecutor they can, got the most biased judge they possibly could, didn't even do a basic background check on any of the jurors to see if anyone's were, say, the grand wizard of their local Klan chapter or anything like that. Didn't do any of that stuff. And even when there was the evidence, because once again, let's make sure we understand something. He was found not, he was acquitted of charges. He still killed those people. And we have drone footage that shows him starting, instigating everything by aiming his gun at people randomly. He started it. He shouldn't have been there. He shouldn't have had the gun. The judge really overstepped his bounds there to dismiss that charge. The judge basically made laws out of his, pulled laws out of his butt to basically get rid of the weapons charge. Yeah, well, in my mind, it needs to be there. Plus the fact that the judge clearly seems to be a racist jackass. Schroeder seems, I mean, his comments about the Asian food, his comments about black, the one black that he was, I mean, come on. Dude has probably got a sheet at home. I mean, I don't know. I can only speculate from what I've seen on TV, and he's a jackass. Because this entire thing, the entire case, was a setup to make sure Rittenhouse did not go to jail. Because if you look at the evidence, he should have gone to jail. He should have gone to jail. It's that simple. It's that simple. I mean, this isn't rocket science. He shouldn't have been there. He had no ties to the community. None. He was illegally carrying the gun. He starts running up to these protesters and aiming the gun at them. And when they start trying to stop him from aiming the gun at him, he murdered them, shooting another, and then walked away to the applause of the police department. He was guilty as hell. He is guilty as hell. And this whole thing was we like to think that court cases are not this fixed, like they were back in the 50s when you had a white guy who might have been accused of a racist act, who all of a sudden the judge was sitting down and joking with during breaks during the trial in the 1950s and 1960s in the South. You'd like to think that that's the case, those cases, that level of bias, that level of injustice that existed a few hundred years, or a few decades ago, maybe 100 years ago. No, it clearly is still today. Let's say the obvious. If he was black, he would have already been in jail for life, if not murdered. Let's be honest, if a black man had walked towards those police officers with a gun, even with his hands in the air, they would have dropped him right there. Let's just be honest about it. If he was black, he would already be dead. If he was black, he's guilty as hell. He is. And the mentality you see being exposed here is, and this is pure wild speculation. This would be, once again, I'm in purely wild speculation, but it sure seems like it. They already know Rittenhouse and his family are screwed in the civil trial. That if God forbid, and I hope that the Department of Justice files civil rights charges against him because he violated the civil rights of other people by aiming guns at them and shooting them. They know that if the federal government files charges against him, or in the civil trial for sure, civil trial is going to take every dime from his family. And they know that. And so my speculation is the judge went into this trial saying, well, you're screwed on that, but I'll make sure at least you're not going to go to jail. That's kind of the mentality. You're going to get punished enough by the fact that your family's going to owe money to these criminals that you shot. So I'm going to make sure you don't really have to suffer that much. So we're going to make sure you're not going to go to jail. I mean, that trial was a joke. Was an absolute joke. And mind you, the judge, if there was some question, some speculation on the drone footage, which showed Rittenhouse prior to the confrontation, which where he shot people, pointing his gun at the protesters. The judge was ready to declare a mistrial if the jury would have come back and found him guilty. They were going to get him off the hook one way or the other. They were going to either a no guilty thing or they were going to declare a mistrial. This judge was a joke. Schroeder is a joke. And there's a lot of things that you can say here. I mean, one of the first things I want to make sure I mention is there's a lot of right-wing jackasses out there right now who are self-gratifying to this verdict. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. They are. They absolutely are. Who tomorrow will sit there and tell you how every black person that took a tube of toothpaste from the Target store down on Lake Street in 55 needs to, they should have been shot on the sight. That this guy, who murdered two people, not another one, and once again, is guilty of everything, that he getting off is, that's justice. That's justice. But then a black person stole one tube of toothpaste. Why haven't they shot him, his family, everyone that ever saw him? That's justice. I mean, the bipolar nature of this is disturbing. I can't. That judge is going to be running for the rest of his life, because I can tell you right now, if I was a family member, I was a family member of one of the victims, I would track him down and I'd say, Judge, I need you to explain to me how my child, how you not only did not allow my child to be labeled as a victim, but then you allowed them to be labeled as an arsonist and a looter and a rioter when you had no evidence they had done any of those things. And it's that judge, there is no soul to Judge Schroeder. I mean, that is just some saying, I don't care. I mean, my guess is he's going to retire. My guess is he, and this was the plan, find some old judge who's half out the door anyway, get him to basically get Rittenhouse off this, and then tomorrow he's like, I am writing my letter of resignation. Screw you, you jackass. Judge Schroeder, you're a jackass. Just, you're a horrible human being. You're just a horrible human being. And you sure as hell are not Christian, you jackass. You are not. I will take you to task on that. Dare you. Dare you debate me with your Bible. Oh, my goodness. I will take you to task with that. Dare you to. Dare you to, judge. Bring it. Nope. If I'm a family member of one of the victims and I saw the judge, I just don't know what I would say to him. But he doesn't care. His job was to make sure Rittenhouse never served a day in jail. And mission accomplished. He can go back to his racist, and like I said, it's through his comments he said during this trial. He seems like a big racist jackass. So he's probably happy with that. There is another element of this which is incredibly disturbing. And it's not something that I think that you would see right away. And it's not what I have pointed out. That Wisconsin, because of Judge Schroeder and because of this, if there is a protest for some reason, and a militia member, not a police officer, a vigilante thinks someone in the crowd has committed a crime, that they can open fire and gun down that crowd left and right and murder any protester they want. Murder any protester they want. Murder 50 of them. And they're going to get off scot-free because they just point Rittenhouse. Because isn't that really what happened? The argument is, well, even though these people, we can't definitively say they committed any crime. Crimes were being committed by other people while these protests were going on, and henceforth, the murder of these people was justified. Isn't that the argument they're saying? Of course it is. And so if I'm a militia member, I am, and I want to shoot especially black people, I am waiting for the next one because I will run up there and I will have loaded guns and I will murder as many people as I can. And I'll put my hands in the air and say, get me Judge Schroeder, Rittenhouse. And that is the standard that has just been created in Wisconsin. Wisconsin, vigilantes can now murder people in the street as part of a large group as long as someone in that group has committed a crime, which then, as Judge Schroeder says, you can use guilt by association. That if one person in there shoplifted a piece of candy from a grocery store, then everyone in there is a hardened criminal thief. And that's their problem. That's their problem. No, that is a standard that's put out there, but that's not the real disturbing one. I'll take a break and I'll come on back. There is a terrifying message that Judge Schroeder just sent down here in this case, which should tell you exactly where this country is at right now. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. 952-946-6205. Once again, courtesy of Judge Schroeder, Rittenhouse, not guilty on all counts. Like I said, and without a doubt in my mind, the civil trial will take every dime they've got from him. But still, we're going to have a lifetime of George Zimmerman-like appearances by Rittenhouse, where he's, you know, doing a celebrity boxing match against some former NBA or something like that. And or he'll auction off his gun to raise money. And yeah, and he'll be the belle of the ball at these far right, you know, stooge conventions. That's going to be it. I imagine they're already trying to book him for the next one. But if there is a court in the world, they take and they basically say you owe $100 million to these families. And then, you know, everything he's doing is basically to pay off his debt to society. At least to the victims. The judge set up something here because not only, let's flip the script here. Does anyone think this judge would have treated this trial the same way if this was pro-Trump protesters furious at the election results and a liberal militia person would have aimed their gun at the Trump people, then confronted them, then shot two and killed them, and then shot a third one who's injured, and then come surrender this? Does anyone really think that Judge Schroeder would have had the same, oh, that you can't call the Trump victims victims? Oh, my God. The guy had the Trump campaign song as his ringtone. He would be eulogizing the victims. Sweet innocent people that man murdered. That'd be the judge. That would be the judge in that trial. But no, because, if you can acknowledge that fact, that the judge who had the Trump campaign song as his ringtone would not hold Trump protesters to the same standard that he held the protesters that night that Rittenhouse shot, then you can honestly say what he is saying is that if it's protesters that he doesn't like, it's okay to murder them. How else am I supposed to interpret that? But it's even more scary when you realize the real underlying of what he is saying with that. He is one step away. Judge Schroeder in this entire trial is one step away from him saying, yep, it's legal to shoot a Democrat. He is. Because once again, if you can honestly say it, there's no way in the world he would have ever treated a liberal armed man who shot two Trump protesters and murdered them and shot a third one, that this judge would have never held the same type of trial for them that they held just for Kyle Rittenhouse. Then you're saying that he basically feels as if Rittenhouse's victims somehow deserved it because of their political ideology, their political beliefs, the side of the aisle that they represented, the people that they represented, not the white culture, the diverse culture. And if you can understand that, if you honestly think that, then it becomes pretty damn clear we are one step away from a judge saying, well, he voted for Biden, so he deserved to be shot. And Schroeder, if he ever hears this, will, how dare you? No, dude, how dare you? Because we all know this. There is no way in hell that if that was a Trump protest and two Trump fans got shot and another one was injured by a leftist gunman, that you would, there is no way in hell you can't call the Trump victims victims. Oh, God. Like I said, you would be eulogized. These were sweet innocent people. Oh, you would be looking to throw the book at the gunman at that point. We all know it, sir. So this is a trial that was conducted through a political prism, because the people that were protesting weren't conservatives or Republicans or Trump fans. Well, they're not victims. They got what they deserved. Rittenhouse was not a child vigilante gunning people down the street. He was a misunderstood rapscallion. And what he's really saying is this, is I'm getting to the point now as Judge Schroeder that if someone came into my courtroom and said, well, I shot them because they were a Democrat, I don't know how harsh I'd be on the guy.
You know, we have to have this trial because you can't shoot people. But let me start by saying this. I completely understand your frustration. They're not voting for my guy, Trump. They voted for Joe Biden. That's frustrating enough. I can understand why your tempers were flaring. Seriously, does anybody doubt this?
No, of course not. Not in the least bit. And so we have now had our first trial in this modern age where quite literally we are one step away from saying shooting people of another political persuasion different from your own is perfectly legal. Now, what they're saying is protesters, but like I said, Schroeder, if this was Trump protesters, there's no way in the world this trial would have gone the same way. No way. No way on the planet this trial would have gone the same way. Even if there were Trump protesters rolling cars and burning down buildings. Nope. No way on the planet Schroeder would have ever allowed this trial to go the same way. So then at this point, what we're saying is, no. He basically had these standards during this trial because of the people that were protesting. And on one side, you had conservative, far-right, loonball militia people looking to gun people down in the streets. And those people, in his mind, were in the right. Those people were in the right to gun those people down, to aim weapons at them, because they were just loony lefties out there protesting. And it might not be so direct and so blunt as saying, oh, you're a DFLer? Shoot him. It might not be that way, but it's pretty damn close. It's a dark freaking day in America, thanks to Judge Schroeder, who basically made sure that Kyle Rittenhouse never serves a day in jail. Mission accomplished, jackass. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. And that's called freedom of speech, by the way. Oh, I guarantee, I might, maybe he'll, how dare you? You're speaking out of turn. Freedom of speech, man. Freedom of speech. Oh, is that right? If I'm a liberal, then my freedom of speech doesn't exist. Screw you. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Come on back. Minnesota coronavirus update, it's not going to be happy time. Let's just put it that way. It's the Matt McNeil Show on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. The fallout from the Rittenhouse trial is immediate here. How about this? There is a new challenger for Minority Leader Kurt Daut. There's no doubt about it. District 31A needs new leadership. This is for Rachel Davis, whose website features a picture of her holding a gun. With imminent crisis facing Minnesota, we can't afford to stay in weak, compromising business as usual politician. In short, we need active fighters representing us. I'm going to presume what she's, that gun then. I'm going to take my gun to the Capitol. I'll fight. Yeah, okay. Rachel has the courage to stand up where other representatives continue to remain silent and ineffective. Whether these representatives are too timid to challenge the tyrannical Democrats or in on the action, the result's the same. They have to go. Rachel is not afraid to tell you her values, and they don't change depending on which group she is speaking to at the moment. She's proud to express her love. By the way, I will back her up about that. There's a lot of Republicans out there who change their speeches depending on who they're talking to. She's proud to express her love of country and our great state. Rachel stands for law and order and the free markets, blah, blah, blah. It's going to be interesting to see how many more of these people. Her website features a picture with her and Mike Lindell. It'll be interesting because the reality is on the Republican side, the primaries are decided by these far-right loon balls. You have to be. The more far-right you are, the better chance you have. And the question becomes this. If you get someone who is that extreme, that far to the right, that is like, I got a gun and I'm willing to fight. And you're like, wow, really? You're going to start shooting people? Is that what you're kind of implying? Because that's kind of what it implies. You're going to start gunning people down at the Capitol because you disagree with the transportation policy? Is that, hey, I disagree with your DNR policy. Bang, 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 bang. Where are you going with this? And you need to clarify that. But the reality is that the question is in these areas where they have brainwashed voters that basically voting for DFLers is tantamount to treason. If you run a fascist-esque type of candidate, will all of a sudden the Democrats start picking up seats? I don't know. I mean, there are some people out there, don't get me wrong, there's a lot of people, especially a lot of media people out there, whose the mentality is, sure, I'd rather have a more moderate Republican. Well, I'm not even good. Kurt Daut's not moderate. He's an extreme far-right Republican. But he goes, I'd rather have him than someone who's extremist, but I guess if I have a point, I'll have gun girl go on in as opposed to a DFLer. I mean, that is the mentality out there. So it will be interesting. I have a feeling that she is the first of many challenges to Republicans who basically people that want to start World War III. I don't know. What are you doing with the gun? As a person that served in the military, what are you doing? Are you trying to scare people? Because you're not scaring me. You don't scare me. You don't. What are you going to do, murder me? I mean, come on. Stop. You're going to go down there and start shooting up the House of Representatives? Is that what you're going to do? Please. You're not. You really are. Or are you? I mean, is this really where you people are at? That how dare your health and human services policy be that liberal? Well, that's march 10 paces and draw. Really? Is that where we're at? Please. Come on. Grow up. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Friday's COVID-19 update from the Minnesota Department of Health includes 5,162 newly reported cases, 30 newly reported deaths, bringing the state's COVID death toll to 9,155. Minnesota's test positivity rate, Minnesota's test positivity rate for the seven-day rolling average is 10.8%, which is up from 10.7% on November 10th. As of November 16th, the state reported that 3,583,889 people have received at least one dose of the COVID vaccine, while 3,335,953 people have completed the vaccine series. The state has administered 786,726 third dose booster shots. Through November 18th, the number of people with COVID-19 hospitalized in Minnesota was 1,414, up from 1,381 reported on November 16th. Of those hospitalized, 340 people are in intensive care, and 1,074 are in non-ICU care. And it should be mentioned, we should run through the hospital staffing here is really scary right now. Staffed adult ICU bed availability. Currently, there are two available in the Northeast region, the Arrowhead region. There's two available in the Northwest region. There's one available in West Central part of the state. In the East Central and Central part of the state, there's one. In the Twin Cities Metro, there's one. There's six down in the Southeast, three in the South Central part of the state, and three in the Southwestern part of the state. Staffed pediatric ICU beds available. Four up on the Arrowhead region, Duluth and North there. Zero in the Central and East Central part of the state. Five in the entire metro area, two in Rochester. Staff pediatric non-ICU bed availability. So these are pediatric non-ICU beds. Zero in the northwestern part of the state. Zero in the west central part of the state. Zero in the central and east central part of the state. Zero in the south central part of the state. You have 17 in the Twin Cities Metro. Five in the southeastern part of the state. Three in the southwestern part of the state. And 10 up in the north. West. You're basically, we are having a crisis of COVID that goes way beyond just COVID cases now. You know, people, you have people with heart attacks, people with strokes, people who are car crash victims. They can't get in, gunshot victims who can't get in to hospitals because so many people are sick with COVID now. And spoiler alert, it's not necessarily coming from the Twin Cities Metro. We'll get to that in a second. Most ICU patients during the duration of the pandemic was 399. That was on December 1st. We are once again at 340. We are 59 away from having the worst outbreak of ICU patients. And that's basically back when we had emergency ICU units in the state as well. There are currently only 19 staffed adult ICU beds available in the entire state, only 11 pediatric ICU beds available. 871,203 is the current amount of people that have been diagnosed in the state of Minnesota with COVID. The latest COVID-19 case rates show that Minnesota and Michigan continue to be the epicenter of the pandemic's latest wave in the United States. According to data from the New York Times, Minnesota is second in the nation at 75 cases per 100,000 residents. The land of 10,000 lakes, which has the worst case rate in the country this earlier this year, has been surpassed by Michigan in the past 24 hours. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say anything over 10 cases per 100,000 people indicates widespread transmission of coronavirus. And once again, if you have 10 per 100,000, you've got widespread transmission. The Delta variant of coronavirus has been tightening its grip on Minnesota for the past 3 months, with new cases every day now routinely between 3,000 and 5,000. It has led to a surge in hospitalizations, with the state health department reporting 1,381 hospitalized patients in COVID-19. On the New York Times list of 100 counties with the highest case rates in the country. Now, here's the problem, because we're going to come back to this in a second. This list doesn't include any counties that have fewer than 10,000 residents. So, but this is their list. 19 of them are in Minnesota. Dodge County is 155 cases per 100,000. Once again, I want to make sure we state this. 10 is widespread outbreak. In Dodge County, it's 155 per 100,000 cases. Wadena, 145. Goodhue, 133. Sherburn, 124. Kennebec, 119. Mille Lacs, 119. Douglas, 115. Todd, 113. Roseau County, 112. Pope County, 110. Pine County, 106. Itasca County, 105. 101 for Benton County. Wabasha is at 100. Meeker's at 100. Wright's at 100. Beltrami's at 99. Kandiyohi is at 97. Morrison is at 96. What do all those counties have in common? Well, for the most part, they're pretty much represented by the Republican Party. And where are the Republicans right now? Where are the Republicans saying, for God's sakes, get vaccinated? As we break the medical system of this state. I mean, is that really what it's going to take? Is all of a sudden, you know, people starting to call these people up and say, why aren't you telling us to get vaccinated? We had to send Grandpa down to Nebraska to get him into an ICU. Hamana, 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 hamana. Trump! That's what they're going to say. If you take away, by the way, the 10,000 population qualifier, there are 22 counties in Minnesota with case rates of 100 or higher. The six Minnesota counties that didn't qualify for the New York Times list are Stevens County at 150 cases per 100,000. Kitson County is at 123. Swift County, 119. Lac-Qui-Parle is 119. Monument is 103. Grant County, 103. By the way, Kitson County, can I ask something? Isn't the nine-man football team that's playing in the state tournament from Kitson?
Yep, they lost today.
Did they lose? Did anyone put a restriction on how many of the fans could be in the stands or if anyone was sick?
Probably not.
For God's sakes, their county is 123 cases out of 100,000. That is 10 is widespread. That's 123. Is anyone at U.S. Bank Stadium checking to see if people are safe to be in the building? Dear Lord, I mean, we already know what's going on. I mean, you have people, some people are asymptomatic, so they're not showing any signs, they don't feel bad, and they're spreaders. But there are, I guarantee you, there are people who are sick, who are like, I just got a little flu, I don't have anything. And they're going there, and they're super spreaders. Kitson County comes on down here. Kitson County is a cesspool of coronavirus right now. Don't tell me we can't put something in place to prevent them from bringing that down here. Ugh. Minnesota and Michigan, by the way, combined for 49 counties in the 100-plus rate, whereas 48 other U.S. states have a combined total of 70. Meanwhile, the metro area and outer suburban counties, oh, that's right. Conservatives are like, what about you liberals? Okay, let's take a look at the liberal numbers here. Scott County is a little high, 93 out of 100,000 cases, as is Carver County. Anoka, 79. Washington County, 75. Dakota County, 69. Hennepin County is only 59. Ramsey County is 56. The comparatively low case rate in Hennepin and Ramsey, and to a lesser extent, the suburban counties, compared with Greater Minnesota, does suggest that vaccination rates are playing a significant role in this spread. That said, there are numerous reasons to contribute to COVID case rates, such as population density, adherence to mitigation measures, and transient population, to name a few. And so, well, in transient population, Kitson County comes on down here. There you go. How many people did they just make sick in the metro area? Seriously. As such, there are outliers within the figures. Good example, Goodyear County has a 72% vaccination rate among those age 12 and up, but it's one of the worst case rates in the U.S., whereas Jackson County has one of the lowest vaccination rates in Minnesota and is currently reporting 32 cases per 100,000. But don't look at the outliers as this. I mean, it's clear the fact is that the unvaccinated counties, the counties that do not have people vaccinated, are clearly driving this outbreak in Minnesota. And I want you to put, you know, on a much lesser thing, because once again, I don't want you dead, I don't want you sick. But let's take a look at the third thing. How many are going into debt beyond their capability of handling with this crisis? How many people that refuse to sign up for the Affordable Care Act because that's what liberals want you to do, so they don't really have health insurance and are facing an average $44,000 hospital bill for a non-ICU case or $145,000 ICU bill from the hospital? How many in rural Minnesota are bankrupting themselves through their political ideology? I mean, will we? I highly doubt we'll see Republicans introduce a bill in the next session where they'll say something to the effect of, oh, well, you know, we're going to try to get some relief for you for your medical bills. Because I can tell you right now, the metro area is, you know, well, we didn't have the problem. You guys did. Maybe they'll send a bunch of people with guns down there, and we're going to make you do it, so you better sign that bill now. And then we're going to head over to the governor's office and hold the guns on him. I guess, I don't know. Maybe that's what they're going to do. I don't know. It would seem like they'd be breaking the law by threatening people with guns. But I won't spoil the surprise for them. I won't spoil the surprise for you when you start threatening your coworkers in the House and the Senate with a gun. That when the police come in and put the cuffs on you and drag you away. What do you mean that's illegal? I'm just making sure, making a political point. Me. Yeah. I'm going to come back. When we take a break, come back, talk about the schools, because I can tell you right now, schools, I'm starting to wonder if it's going to be best for us to shut down the schools through the holidays and go to remote learning. I'll explain that when I do come back. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. This is the Matt McNeil Show. Yeah, it is going to be interesting to see where the Republican Party goes from here, because clearly there are a lot of people who have got guns who feel as if the two options is either to threaten people to do what they want to do, or at least the implication is we'll shoot who we dislike. And if that's where the party goes, it's, you know, this country is going to turn to chaos. And that's not every Republican, mind you, but there's a lot of them. A lot of people who will make excuses for them. Let's make sure we understand it. I'm a little concerned about where this country's going. 952-946-6205. I want to make a plea to all parents out there. I'm a parent myself. I've had kids who are sick. I've had kids who are sick on days where I've been really busy, and it's tough. I understand that. Don't send a sick kid to school. I've already talked to a few people at schools where what they're finding is their parents are knowing their kid is sick, filling them full of medication, so they go to school and their fever's not there. But by noon or so, all of a sudden the medication's worn off. The kid's it's clear the kid is very sick, and all of a sudden they've exposed people, because even though they might take some medication and the fever might go away, doesn't mean they're not still contagious. And so I want to plead with you, please, if you've got a sick kid, keep them at home. I understand it's a mild inconvenience, but killing people because you just don't want to keep your kid home and end up having a teacher die or another kid in the school get seriously sick, come on. Enough's enough. Now, I'm not sure exactly what's happened here, but in the metro area, we've got some schools that are going downhill. The K-5 school in Minnetonka says nearly 7% of its students now have COVID. The district's coronavirus response page shows 60 active COVID cases among students at Groveland Elementary, which reported enrollment of 895 last year. A spokesperson for the district confirmed the figure, adding the school is being impacted by the alarming rise in infections seen statewide. We're continuing to watch the case counts and put additional mitigation strategies into place as needed. The 60 cases at Groveland School account for about 30% of 96 active COVID cases seen across the Minnetonka District's 11 schools. It also is the highest single figure among any of the schools. Most classrooms in a school have either 0 or 1 cases, a spokeswoman for Groveland said. Well, but you still got 60. The district as a whole experienced a surge from November 3rd to 10th, going from just over 50 cases overall to about 175 during that period. So things tough in Minnetonka. Shakopee as well. Shakopee School District is closing all of its schools on Monday and Tuesday to deal with the COVID-19 outbreak and will be off all week, since the district is already scheduled to be off Wednesday through Thanksgiving Friday. Released on Thursday evening, district officials say they have the most infections in the past 3 weeks since the beginning of the pandemic, and cases continue to rise in Minneapolis suburb county of Scott County. Minnesota is also leading the country in rate of new COVID-19 infections, despite the widespread availability of vaccines and the vaccination rate above the national average. Hospital critical care beds are full, and health officials have been sounding alarms for days. The Shakopee School District has no COVID-19 vaccine mandate and requires masks when cases hit certain thresholds. I'm going to guess you might want to revisit this, because if your policy is so bad that now you're just having to shut the school down completely, I don't know if your mask mandate, vaccine mandate policies are there. And I get it. There's going to be some howler monkeys that are going to show up at the Shakopee school board meetings. Let them. They're deranged loon balls that are trying to scream their will upon you. Do not let them win. You're there for the betterment of people. You're a school, for God's sakes. Base your decisions on science, not the howler monkeys. All right. District officials released a statement saying the cases are affecting student and staff attendance and forced them to move three classrooms from in-person to distance learning, and with a handful of other classrooms nearing the threshold. The district will continue to monitor the situation and explore possible additional mitigation steps and school schedule adjustments, the district statement said. Our goal is to have some control over the situation and be proactive whenever possible. Amanda McKnight's daughter, Fiona 8, is a third grader at the elementary school in Shakopee and tested positive Wednesday night, a week after getting her first dose of vaccine. This is the first time we've been compromised through the whole pandemic, McKnight said. Well, yeah, if you have a school district that's not looking out for the people. A couple of weeks ago, a class at Fiona's school went virtual, and ever since, more cases keep cropping up. McKnight was notified by the school that her daughter came in contact with infected students Monday and Tuesday. We've been getting infected like crazy. She said it's out of control. So far, her daughter is feeling like she has a cold. She also was notified that a parent at the daycare where her four-year-old son goes tested positive. He was born with a cleft lip and palate and doesn't handle respiratory illness as well. Children age 5 to 11 now get the vaccine, but Monty's not old enough yet, McKnight lamented. Well, I think part of this is, you know, the policy you have in place there doesn't seem to be doing the job in Shakopee. We'll take a break. Come back. Hour 2 up next. Broadcasting from the Rudy Luther Toyota Studios at AM 950, it is the Matt McNeil Show. By the way, it is Thanksgiving week coming up here. Brett Johnson joining us in studio. Patrick here as well. The Park Tavern, our good friends there, of course, last year with COVID, did not have the Thanksgiving buffet. They are doing it again, though, this year. And, yeah, it is a good sign indeed. They've got not only the turkey, they got the potatoes and the mac and cheese. They've got shrimp. Okay, I'm okay with that. And they got the ham. Chicken parmesan, that sounds pretty good. The kibasas, they got the desserts, smoked salmon, all the stuff there. They're doing this. They got reservations from 11 till 3, but you have to have reservations. You get an hour of bowling with that as well, which is a lot of fun. It's just going to be a good time there. If you're looking for some fun there with the Thanksgiving holiday coming on up here, there you go. Go to parktavern.net. That's parktavern.net. I am hopefully going to have Terry Zila on either Monday or Tuesday. I'm not sure.
Yeah, you got to get him on. Always a Thanksgiving tradition.
Yeah. This has been a day.
No kidding. I hear you. Yeah.
I got Dury coming up here. I'm looking forward to that. The band Dury out of Burnsville, who if they continue with what they're doing, I think they're going to be massive. And I really do. I think that they're going to be huge. But I'll get to that. And of course, you and Ricardo Lopez are going to be talking here in just a moment about The Grotto. Hello there.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting since Jeremy Miller is really trying to distance himself from this thing. So I asked Ricardo about it too. Is this Paul Gazelka that made the push for having this little private club?
Is it?
Because he doesn't know. He's digging into it. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Because Jeremy Miller seems like he wants no part of it. So
we'll get to that in a second.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, some people just don't like a good lap dance. I mean, or to perform a good lap dance. That's let's right. be honest about yeah, what yeah, we're yeah. talking about here. does Jeremy Miller look good in the thong? I mean, it's like it's those dollar bills sometimes paper cuts right in that center region. That's tough.
He's looking out for his health.
Oh, it's a disturbing thought process, but gosh, it's funny as heck because you guys walked into that rake yourselves. Let's just put it that way. All right, so Rittenhouse, your thoughts on the Rittenhouse trial?
Not really surprised what happened. I mean, you could kind of see this coming from a mile away with the judge and the way he was conducting himself. And as you said, that sets up a pretty terrifying precedent for what happens in Wisconsin if someone else ends up going and gunning down protesters. All you need to say is, I was scared.
Well,
and
no,
you're getting away.
Actually, no, you don't have to say I was scared. You just have to say, well, there was a criminal in the group.
Right, yeah.
And I felt threatened, and so I started shooting. And we're not talking about police officers. We're talking about just vigilante militia types can start gunning down people in Wisconsin now because of this ruling. And that's just – it's the scariest thing I've seen in my life.
I think you hit the nail on the head last hour when you said that he probably thinks, yeah, he's going to – Kyle Rittenhouse is going to get destroyed in the civil lawsuit. That's probably his way of saying, well, you know, you're getting enough with the civil lawsuit, you know.
You're going to get punished there. If there's federal charges that are filed, you're going to lose a civil rights case.
Yeah.
If the feds file charges against you.
I think that you're onto something there.
So I think this judge went in there saying, you're going to get punished enough later on, so I'm going to make sure you don't serve a day in jail. At least that's the impression I got from it. And you tell me how else I'm supposed to interpret this trial. The other thing I wanted to bring up with you is, do you feel as if this judge, Judge Schroeder, would have in any way, shape, or form had the same trial if the protesters were Trump fans upset about the election and the shooter was a leftist who had done everything that Kyle Rittenhouse had done, a 17-year-old leftist who came in there? Do you think that Schroeder would have run the same exact trial?
Of course not.
Not at all. Not in the least bit. Nope. Not. He has the Trump theme song on his cell phone. He has a Trump theme song on his cell phone. So do we have to?
Just for Patrick, we got our engineer who's looking at our transmitter waiting at the door.
Yeah. We were going to mention something here because you're watching us. We've had a little bit of transmitter issues. We're down a little bit on the power. We've had a little internet issues, but it seems like that's working now.
Yeah. You know, if the transmitter's going to go down, you might as well have the internet go down as well and just have it all happen in just one big barrel of fun.
That show is called Matt Sleeps. Because we have done a show here where we did not broadcast it. We just did it online for the online viewers. It was the Law Show.
Oh, that's right.
We
yes, didn't remember the Law Show? Yes.
We did the Law Show, and I love the Law Show. We need to do more of the Law Shows. But we've done that. So if you're wondering why we might sound a little staticky, that's the reason why. Of course, we are now in the evening. We should mention, too, there's a lot of ways for you to watch the show, listen to the show. We're live on TuneIn Radio app, live on the AM 950 radio page, where, of course, you can podcast us on iTunes, Spotify, SoundCloud, all those places. You can get all the shows there. You can as well, of course, listen to us live in Minneapolis, St. Paul on AM 950. So lots of things. And you can watch the show, which I still, why? Why would you put a camera on me? I mean, it's like, it's like putting a camera on the baboons at the zoo. I mean, you're going to get some fun monkey stuff, but there's a lot of bad things you're about to witness here. Oh my God, what's he doing to himself? Holy God. Oh, turn that off. How red is his butt? You know, no, I don't need that. Why would you do this to the viewers?
We endure to expand access to your show. It's what we put up with.
We're hip kids embracing modern technology. All right. Ricardo Lopez, the grotto time. I still can't believe the Republicans are going through with this. This is just too funny.
It's just funny that they're trying to distance themselves. But someone clearly started it, and that's what we got to figure out, Ed. We don't know for sure, but my suspicion leads me to thinking it is Gazelka.
This portion of our show is brought to you by McMillan Knee Pads. I don't know what you need them for, but McMillan Knee Pads keep your knees nice and safe. Anyway, let's talk about how the Republicans are going to be working with the lobbyists in their own little private grotto party room. Sorry. Here it is. It's Brett Johnson with Ricardo Lopez. It's the interview right here on AM 950.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Brett Johnson back with you here on a Friday afternoon. Right now we're joined by Ricardo Lopez, who is the senior political reporter for the Minnesota Reformer, website minnesotareformer.com, for the latest in Minnesota news and politics, as we're going to be chatting about something that we've been talking about a lot here on the Matt McNeil Show, and that has to do with this new private club that the Senate GOP could be setting up for legislatures, members of the legislature, and lobbyists during session. And now we have Democrats vowing that they plan to close the loophole that would allow the private GOP club for lobbyists. We'll be talking a lot about that with Ricardo. Hey, Ricardo, how are you doing today? Thanks for joining me on the show.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so walk me through exactly what is happening right now, because the way I'm looking at it is that basically this finance or this Senate Victory Fund, which is affiliated with the Senate GOP, received approval from the Minnesota Campaign Finance Board to create a private meeting space for legislatures and lobbyists and others dues-paying members, which doesn't sound like a really good thing for government transparency. So walk us through exactly on what this potential private club is.
Yeah, so last month, the Minnesota Campaign Finance Board published this what they call an advisory opinion, came down in early October, and essentially, what was interesting about the opinion was that it didn't say who sought it, and so that was sort of the first question, but it did identify that a political party unit, typically one of the caucuses in the legislature, had asked their advice on whether this idea that they were thinking about would be okay under state law. So essentially, what Senate Republicans wanted to know was whether they could create a private meeting space for lawmakers and for other dues-paying members that they could, meet and talk about legislation that it helps advance their party's interests. They wanted to know, if we set it up like this, would that be okay? So essentially, the Campaign Finance Board said, as long as the dues are campaign contributions and they don't happen in the legislative session, then it's okay. And the reason that's important is because there is a state law that bans campaign contributions during the legislative session.
Interesting. So the Campaign Finance Board, as you said, gave the approval on this, and basically they said in their opinion that they don't necessarily have to like the law, but it is the law, and the legislature has their own power to change it if so. So this really is all legal, even though it doesn't really look good for transparency.
Absolutely. I mean, I think this is something that people who want to see clean and transparent government, this would definitely be a big step backwards in that regard, because, it really does harken back to the days of the kind of the smoke-filled, backroom dealings that used to happen before, right? I mean, one of the things that the opinion said is that lobbyists who become members of this club do so with personal funds. And that if they then sought reimbursement from their clients or their employers, the reporting sort of gets triggered as well. So in the mind of one advocate, for clean government, she said, why else would a lobbyist spend their own personal money on a club like this if it's not to advance their client's interests? So, it just really does do a disservice to figuring out who is meeting with lawmakers and who has influence at the Capitol.
The other interesting aspect I found reading through is that the timing of when those membership dues also appears to be a big deal in terms of whether this is legal or not. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Right. And so the Campaign Finance Board essentially said that, in terms of the timing, as long as the dues are paid before the start of the session or come after the session is over, then it's okay. It doesn't run afoul of that state ban on campaign contributions during the session. So that is one thing that lawmakers have always been very careful about following, because they never want to be seen as their votes during session having anything to do with campaign contributions. But this essentially makes it so that as long as you pay your membership dues before the start of session, you're in the clear.
So what is the justification that either the Senate GOP or at least the Senate Victory Fund, what are they saying in terms of why they're trying to set up this kind of private club? What are they saying publicly about at least what this meeting space could be used for?
Well, they're not saying very much at all, actually. And in fact, we're really reluctant to talk about it when I called and emailed and asked questions about it. And given the timing of the opinion, which came down in October 6th, I believe, and when Senator Jeremy Miller was elected caucus leader, it might predate his time as majority leader. So, he has said publicly, and he told me last week or earlier this week, that they have no plans to pursue this. And that came, after pretty strong backlash to the idea. And I think that, what that tells you about the situation is just, kind of doesn't pass the smell test with a lot of people, because, it kind of creates this system where there's almost like this two tiers of access to lawmakers, right? People who want to meet with their representatives want to be able to know that they have access to them, and that there's not like a premium level of access that comes with them, something like a club like that. So it's still a little unclear who first came to the board with that idea, but we do know it was the Senate GOP's political arm, the Senate Victory Fund.
I'm not sure if you know the answer to this, but would the previous leader, Paul Gazelka, is this something that he may have pursued, or do we just not have that information?
I'm trying to get that information. I don't have that as of now. But yeah, I mean, I think the next opportunity I can, I will ask him if he was aware of this, because like I said, you know, the current Senate GOP leader was not, did not say very much about it, but did say, you know, they have no plans to pursue this. But of course, with the campaign finance board saying, you know, it's okay, I'd be curious to know whether, you know, anybody, you know, moves ahead with something like this, especially when there's nothing outright banning it.
And as you alluded to, there was quite a backlash when it was announced that this possible private club could be set up from Democrats and good government advocates like Common Cause. They brought up major problems with this as well, as you can talk about some of the objections they had.
Yeah, I mean, as I pointed out earlier, you know, it just creates this you know, you're having if you have lobbyists that are meeting with lawmakers in a private space like this, you know, it's hard to say, you know, whose fingerprints are on a bill as it moves through the session. And it's not even entirely necessary, is what somebody else told me, which is just that, you know, lawmakers already have places they can meet lobbyists. They have their offices that can do things by phone. There's just so many ways to do it. What's unclear, or one of the reasons that they wanted to create the club, seemingly is because of the lack of public meeting space currently at the Capitol, partly because of the pandemic, but also because of security concerns. But you know, that aside, there's still other ways to meet with people in order to, you know, talk about legislation or talk about issues as they come up at the Capitol.
So I know on the DFL side in the Senate, Senator Lindsey Port wants to close this loophole. Talk a little bit about what she's saying about this in terms of trying to introduce some legislation that would close the ability for the Senate GOP to set up this private space.
Yeah, she tweeted the story we published last week and said she would be proposing legislation on this. And I spoke with her this week, and she told me she'd be meeting with Senate counsel about, you know, how to draft the bill to do that, because, you know, as she said, this creates the type of system in which, you know, there's this two-tier level of access to lawmakers, and it's just not good for government transparency. You know, already the Minnesota legislature is a pretty opaque institution there. You know, unlike other branches of government, they are not subject to the Data Practices Act. So, you know, if we wanted to seek public records from the legislature, they made themselves exempt. So this only hurts the, you know, efforts to hold lawmakers accountable.
So how exactly does Minnesota compare with our transparency laws to other states? As I understand it, we usually picture Minnesota as always being among the best in several different categories when we talk about good government. But in this case, we actually rank kind of low, if you can talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, the Center for Public Integrity, you know, does a ranking state by state about, you know, how transparency, how clean government is. And I believe Minnesota earns an overall D- rating. You know, and part of that is because of, you know, the reasons I mentioned that legislators are not subject to the Data Practices Act. So we can't do things like request our emails or request their communications on certain topics, you know. And I think that, you know, something like that is a really important tool to hold people in government accountable. As for the sort of image that Minnesota has as being a pretty well-run state, I mean, I think that type of impression really only benefits lawmakers and those who hold elected positions here.
And final question for you, Ricardo, before we wrap things up. I know we were talking about Lindsey Port possibly putting through a bill that would close some of these loopholes. Have we heard anything, at least on the GOP side, in terms of maybe support for trying to close this loophole, being that at least it sounded like from Jeremy Miller, he was very, very cool to actually trying to implement this club, even though it has been approved if they want to go with it?
Right. I mean, I think that's going to be sort of an interesting question to follow in the upcoming session. Because there were some Republicans I saw that were against this kind of idea, and simply because, you know, it's one, it's unnecessary. Two, you know, really hurts transparency at the legislature. But we'll see if they are willing to support something like this, because ostensibly it wouldn't just affect them. It would affect all political caucuses. But, you know, the Senate Victory Fund, and all the other caucuses do fundraise a lot from lobbyists and from other corporate interests and things like that.
Yeah, well, it'll be interesting to follow along in the coming months, especially as we head into the next session early next year, to see if the Senate GOP does go through with this. We have been speaking with Ricardo Lopez. He is the senior political reporter for the Minnesota Reformer. Again, make sure you check them out for the latest in Minnesota news and politics at MinnesotaReformer.com. That's MinnesotaReformer.com. Ricardo, really appreciate the time today. Thanks for coming on the show.
Absolutely. Thank you.
So as we talked about with Ricardo, we're not exactly sure who in the Senate GOP was pushing for this private club for members of the state legislature to meet with lobbyists, but man, this sounds like ALEC on steroids, if you remember the old American Legislative Exchange Council. Well, that'll wrap things up for our interview with Ricardo Lopez of the Minnesota Reformer today. We'll take a break and turn things back over to Matt McNeil up next on AM 950.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. We were talking last hour about Kitson County having a football team represented, and Kitson County is one of the worst outbreak areas in the state for COVID right now. And Patrick, you follow high school sports more than I do here. You said that, where are these other teams from?
Cass and Manorville, which is from Dodge County, they had a game this afternoon against Becker, which they won. So, as you and I were talking about, the worst county in the state is Dodge County, so they were here.
Yeah, Dodge County, the worst county in the state. We actually had, are there mask mandates? Is there vaccine mandates? I mean, is there anything like that over at U.S. Bank Stadium for these football games?
I don't want to say authoritatively because I'm not sure, but my guess would be no.
No, I guess it would be no, too. It gets worse and worse and worse. All right, I specifically set this day up. I mean, and as a matter of fact, we've had just atrocious news today. The Rittenhouse trial, COVID, it's been a bad day. But a few weeks ago, I stumbled onto something that made me feel very, very good. And what we're going to do is I'm going to start by playing you a song. There is a local band named Dury. They're out of Burnsville. They're freaking brilliant. And when we're going to play their first song here in a second. Here's like, who's laughing now? But when we do return after that song, I'm going to play the whole song. It's great. When we return, I'm going to bring in Austin Dury, who is, along with his sister, the band Dury. And we're going to talk about them because I think they're going to be huge. I think they're fantastic. So, Patrick, when you get the chance here, let's play Who's Laughing Now.
7 days a week. But baby, I just paid the rent, making music with my friends. It ain't much, but it could be the start of something big. I'm just as broke as the day I was born, but I still make it work just like everybody else.
The band is Dury. Austin Dury is kind enough to join us today to talk about what is one of my favorite first songs ever I've ever heard from a band, and their rising success so far. Austin, thank you very much. I appreciate the time, my friend.
Hey, thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Congratulations on all of this, man.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It's been wild.
Oh, I have to. You kind of broke in what is a most modern way on TikTok. I mean, you guys. I was looking up on your TikTok page. You're what, 240,000 views of that video?
Yeah, well, that the first one was 200. The when we posted like the music video for it, that was at 500,000 views. Yeah, so it's all tallied up. I think we're at about 1 million views. From all the videos put together.
You know, as a person who has to go up on social media, was there something you guys did? Or I mean, I've always said that I think that just quality comes to the top. And the reality is that's a great song.
Well, thank you. Yeah. You know, I think there's a combination of luck and timing. The first thing that blew up was like a demo. I had only written a verse and a chorus of that song, and so it was just like a little demo in our bad little closet studio of me just playing the song. And that's the first thing that blew up. And then the follow up, so I think that was kind of that journey from the demo to the final version is what really piqued people's interest and kept it going, you know.
Austin, this is, of course, the band Dury is you and your sister, Taryn. I want to ask you, your story is kind of interesting. You were in a band, Coyote Kid, right?
Yep, correct. Yep.
And you were planning on, like a lot of people, I mean, 2020 was a year of disappointment because you were going to do a big tour with that band and head out across the country. And then, of course, pandemic smacked that down, correct?
Correct, exactly. Yeah, we worked super hard on a tour. I booked everything myself. It was like the biggest tour we'd ever done. And because 2020 was going to be our year, you know, but guess not.
So you end up living at home like a lot of people did. I mean, it's jobs were lost. You weren't going on tour, so you're not making money. So you go back home. Your sister is there. You're 29. She's 21. And you both have, obviously, I saw the Star Tribune story on you. You both have music background here, that this is not just a fluke that both of you have this, that you guys grew up with music.
Yeah, yep, yeah. We were homeschooled, and both my parents were ex-teachers, a music teacher and an art teacher. So when you're homeschooled in that kind of house, it's usually ends up a little, maybe lopsided but I think it turned out for the best.
When did you, we are about to go to Thanksgiving. It's a time of year where we're reminded why we don't like to get together with a lot of family members. You are sitting with your sister and you say, okay, maybe we should, since we're stuck here in pandemic, maybe we should start our own band. I mean, talk about how that started.
Yeah, so, you know, it started out as, you know, kind of just with an abundance of time, I just started goofing around with new music and totally different than Coyote Kid and totally different genre and everything. And I was trying to just kind of express my own honest feelings and also, you know, mess around with some synths and some more poppy like structure and stuff like that. And so it started out with just, you know, Taryn was always around. And so I would always like pull her in to the little studio space and be like, what do you think of this? Like, is this cool? Is this hip? And is this what, like, you know, the Gen Z kids are going to be like into? She's my Gen Z vision. Right. So she was there kind of coaching it along until, at one point later on, we were just like, you know, she's looking for a new creative project. We're both stuck at home. Like, might as well just like try and do this thing. So yeah, it's her first musical project, like, writing and being in a band and stuff, and but she's taking to it really quick and it's going really good.
And you talk about that process. I mean, it was easy to understand. You've got the opportunity. Let's explore some different avenues here. But, you know, for her, did you have to talk her into this, or is this something she was chomping at the bit to get involved in?
There was definitely a little bit of persuasion, but to get her involved, but because you know she'd never done anything like this before. But she had the music background and had the creative knack for it. So I definitely saw a lot of potential. But now that she's given it a little more time and put in a little more effort, she's all in and she's really enjoying it. So,
if you're wondering if you appeal to Generation Z, I've got three kids, 20, 17, and 14. They've listened to your music and they say, "Wow, that's great." And then the next question is, "Why is he talking to you, Dad?" And I'm like, I guess pity. I don't know pity. It would be my guess. It's the realism. That's, I think, the thing I love about your band and the lyrics you write is it's unapologetic, and it's not something that is satire or anything like this. It's just written of, this is the freaking world, and here you go. And I mean, there's something, and it's incredibly relatable, which is something you guys have achieved that not many bands can do.
Mm. Yeah, we always say our like band motto is like, everything sucks, but it's all good. Like, that's our outlook is like positive spin, but also like acknowledging the, you know, the darkness and all the things in the world.
How quickly did the song start to come to you?
Like just this one, this particular song?
Well, no, just the album here. As you're putting these songs together.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
Yeah. When did it just start getting faster and faster?
Yeah, you know, I have this thing where, like, if I write a song really fast, I know it's probably pretty good. And if it takes a long time and is like a drag, then like I usually give up on it because it's probably not going to turn out that good. Yeah, honestly, each of these songs kind of came in their own time, but they all came pretty quickly. Like, we didn't have to grind out anything, you know. Who's Laughing Now? I wrote the first verse on a drive to get coffee, and then and wrote the chorus on the way back, and then made the TikTok, and then like the next day I just like finished it, and then the final verse I actually wrote on the way to the studio to record it on the third day after the TikTok blew up, the second day actually, and then we posted it on the third day. But yeah, it goes quick, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, and I like how you say it, is that there's you know when it's right.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I got to tell you, like I said, I mean, when I was talking about you working with your sister here on this, I know there's a lot of people that, you know, it's great that you have that relationship with your sister, that you were able to kind of do something like this. But I mean, it is a pretty big leap to go from, you know, obviously sibling to creative partner.
Yeah, definitely. You know, it's definitely the first time we've like worked on anything together. So, you know, it was kind of a new angle on our relationship that we had to, we're still figuring it out, but yeah, you know, we have a pretty similar, upbringing and everything. So there's a lot of commonality to fall back on in the creative process too.
Have you had a lot of people come to you and say, how do I make it big on TikTok?
a couple, yeah. And I'm always like, I don't know, man. we got lucky. I have no idea.
No, first write a kick-ass song, then you will have success. I mean, I don't want to, you know, I am a bit fanboying it here because I think you are brilliant. And I think you really do have a really great sound. I think the lyrics are sensational, and the success that you're starting to get is very well deserved. But that's the reality of it, is that, you know, people are looking for a gimmick. It's not, I mean, no one goes to my OnlyFans page for a reason. You know, it's just kind of one of those things where if there's not a reason to go there, then people won't. And, you know, it's, if you develop a song, you write a song, and it's good, people show up for the product.
Yeah. You know, we early on, you know, a part of this whole thing was developing like the visual style and stuff like that. So kind of the only gimmick we really landed on was, the yellow thing was that, like, we're just going to be like, people see these yellow backdrops, they'll know that's us. Like,
and you have actually, was it Fred Durst, is now a fan and you're starting to get some national attention on this.
Yeah, I know. Fred Durst was, he was like one of the first 100 like comments on the very first thing. He was like really early on, and he ended up like messaging me on Instagram, and he only follows like a small handful of people, and we're one of them, and he, you know, comments on our stuff all the time, and it's wild to have that level of, you know, celebrity or whatever, like caring, you know, about it. But yeah, and then a lot of international attention too. At one point we were like on the iTunes charts in like Sweden, and then also in Ireland too.
Cool.
Which was pretty wild. Yeah, but I don't know how everyone found it. I mean, I assume TikTok, but pretty wild.
Good stuff rises to the top, man. You explained Who's Laughing Now. Let's talk about your new, this is a new one, single that's came out today. It's Worse for Rare, right?
Yep, correct.
All right, what's the story behind that song?
Yeah, this one I actually wrote before Who's Laughing Now. This was like the next one we had slated to come out, and then we kind of snuck Who's Laughing Now into the middle just because it, you know, blew up so big. But Worse for Wear is, you know, it's a little bit, I don't know, almost like sarcastic, I guess, but it's kind of just examining, you know, the state of the world that the next generation is taking on, and kind of playing up the old parental trope of like, leave it better than you found it, and then like kind of exposing the hypocrisy and
leave us something. Yeah, maybe we will leave something better for you. Correct. Oh, did we lose Austin? Oh, we might have lost Austin. I'll tell you what. Let's play Worse for Wear right now. Go ahead and let's play Worse for Wear. We'll get Austin on back here.
A little bit worse for wear, a little bit scared, a little under.
Worse for wear, that's from Dury here. Austin Dury, kind enough to join us here to talk about the success that they've been having here as out of Burnsville. I thought there was a law in the state that if you're from Burnsville, you can't be successful. Well, it's maybe it's a state law. I'm by a byline. Austin, congratulations. I love the point you made about this, about the hypocrisy of the people saying always leave the world better than you got it. Well, considering the world they're leaving you at this point, it's not exactly a motivational speech.
Yeah, definitely. We I always try to have a little bit of like a positive spin on our songs, and this one just kind of like didn't get one. Oh, well.
Well, but it's like I said, there's a purity to the lyrics, which is, it's just, it's lost. I mean, I hear a lot of bands and I hear a lot of music and we get a lot of stuff that comes through. And you can, you know, there is a feeling I had when I heard you guys for the first time. It was like Dessa. The first time I heard Dessa, it's like, okay, that's different and good. Or the first time I heard Churches or something like that. And you're like, okay, this is different. This is good. You guys are really able to capture something that I think a lot of bands, they struggle very hard to do because, as you said, I think, and maybe part of it is, as you say, you just kind of, it writes itself sometimes and you just out it comes.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, every once in a while it sounds like a little bit of a struggle, but it's always best when it just spills right out and all the melodies work out and it all just kind of happens. That's when you're in the sweet spot.
You, I've got, what night is the 7th Street Entry show?
That is on Wednesday, the 24th, Blackout Wednesday is what I've heard it called. But, that show is going to be awesome. It's all sold out, unfortunately, but I mean, not unfortunately, we're pumped about it being sold out, but for anybody else.
Well, I mean, here's the deal, folks. We don't encourage crime, but if you do need to buy a ticket at more than face value, I will make an argument that this is going to be one of those shows you're going to wish you were at. And because it's not just you. Who's the opening bands?
We have Faith Boblett and also They Self, two other great local bands.
And it's going to be a big show. Any other shows scheduled at this point?
You know, we have a really, really big one, but I can't quite announce it yet. But we have a really big one. We're announcing it on Monday, I believe. Right. Keep a lookout for that one. But it's a local one in Minneapolis. In January. That's all I'll say for now. But it's the biggest show we've ever played. So
cool.
It'll be a big one.
Also, obviously, I'm not sure exactly how your record contract structure is here. You are getting a lot of interest from record labels, right?
Yeah, you know, there is no record contract structure at all yet. We're all totally independent right now. But we've been chatting with a lot of record labels. Like, I stopped responding to record labels because there's too many. We're talking with some pretty big ones and some medium ones and publishing, and everyone's chomping at the bit. So we have a lot of decisions to make coming up, business decisions, trying to make our team and really take this thing to the next level. But that's all going to be a process to make it happen. But in the meantime, we're just going to keep on cranking out music and doing our thing.
If I can ask, what kind of is your mentality towards this? Because on one side of it, it sounds like a cool project that got you through the pandemic, but then it blows up. And obviously, you got your work with Coyote Kid that's out there. Your sister, this is her first experience with it. Is this something where, because of the way that it's resonated and the popularity that's started to be built up, I mean, are you guys saying, you know what, hey, let's be committed to this for a while?
Yeah, we definitely are. Taryn actually just quit her job to do this, like, full time. So so we are we're in it now. So we kind of have like a couple months rent saved up. So we're like, okay, we're gonna give this a real shot and see where we go. But we're definitely firing all cylinders, hoping for the best. We'll see. We'll see where it all goes. I was going to mention too about the show that's all sold out. We'll be live streaming it on TikTok. Cool. And we'll have the phone like hooked up to the soundboard and stuff, so it should hopefully sound somewhat decent. But so we invited all our TikTok followers to to tune in, and they can, like, you know, send us some money if they want to pay for a ticket or whatever. But but yeah, so we're expecting our last live stream had, you know, 16,000 people watching Barbershop with a capacity of 50 people in a show, you know. So so I'm hoping for a lot of people tuning into that.
I will commend you. I think not only, I mean, obviously, like I said, I think success comes with quality. And so, and I stand by that. So, I mean, there. But you also seem to know what you're doing. So good for you.
We're trying.
That's good for you. Austin, yeah. I can't tell you. Like I said, the first time I caught this song, I said, wow, I hope these guys make it huge. And I really do hope you guys make it huge. Congratulations on the sold out gig. Congratulations on the record contract. We'll look forward to that. I'll play one more song when I come on back after the break. But all my best. And come back. Please come back anytime you want to come on my show. Please do.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Austin Dury. Dury is the band. Like I said, I'm not saying you should break the law, but if someone's offering you a ticket to that 7th Street show coming up on the 24th, you probably want to get a ticket. That's going to be one of those that you'll be remembering. Dury, we'll take a break. Come on back. Wrap up the show for a Friday. It's the Matt McNeil Show on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Lisa on the Facebook feed saying, these songs are great. They make my day. Yeah, after a crap news day, good music does help quite a bit. And Dury, like I said, D-U-R-R-Y, find their music. They're good. They're really good. Out of Burnsville. And if they keep going the way they're going right now, they're going to go a long way. And like I said, the 7th Street Entry show on Wednesday is sold out. But listen, I'll make sure I promote with the concert he was talking about coming up here in January. That's going to do it for us for the week. We are back on a Monday and Tuesday next week. Have a wonderful weekend. Try to stay warm. Taking us out today, it is the last Dury song I'm going to play, Losers Club. This is Dury. It's right here on AM 950. Have a good weekend. Till Monday. See ya.